Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who feel disillusioned from church. On today's Off-Grid Christianity podcast is a gentleman who, together with Peter Anderson and John Blanchard in 1980, founded Christian Ministries, having worked together at Movement for World Evangelization, or MWE for short. Our guest is also well known for being a professional team chaplain, as well as an author and broadcaster. So what were MWE and Christian Ministries? Which professional football team is our guest the chaplain for? Gives me great pleasure today to talk to Derek Cleave. Derek, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Loads to chat through and everything else like that. But before we do, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring if that's right. Got five maybe not so sensible questions to ask you. Are you ready, sir?
All ready? Yeah.
Good stuff. Great. Question number one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
I gave a lot of thought to this question, even more so than the other few that will follow. And my final decision is George Whitefield, the 18th century English evangelist, who actually spent quite a bit of time in America also preaching there. And they reckon that he may have preached 20,000 times in his life, sometimes 12 or 13 times a week. But being involved in evangelism and a lot of that, open air stuff and so on and so forth, never was the pastor of a church. Dare I say that I have a fellow feeling with George Whitefield.
And just to put the record straight, I do know you. I've known you for about 30, 40 years. So the reason I'm saying that is that somebody very kindly, when I contacted him, I was just about giving up work to look after Alison full time. And I was speaking to you and I said, have you got any good books I can read? You know, biographies. I like reading Christian biographies. And you sent me through the biography of George Whitefield.
Yeah.
Which I did send back, by the way.
good.
Just in case. Yes, it was very interesting about George Whitefield. Somebody last week chose John Wesley as his hero.
Yeah, well, they worked together, and there were disagreements over some of their theological points, but George Whitefield asked that John Wesley should conduct his funeral, so that was good that they resolved that.
That's very good, isn't it? That's very good. Wasn't he from Gloucester originally, George Whitefield?
Yes. Yes, he was.
Yeah. Great stuff. Okay, question two. Thank you. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Well, when I looked at that, I presumed that we excluded Jesus from this. In other words, except him.
Yes.
And I've come down on the Apostle Paul.
Okay.
Lots of answers one could have given, but Paul, I mean, the greatest evangelist who ever lived, the greatest missionary who ever lived, the greatest preacher who ever lived, the greatest pastor who ever lived. Just a remarkable man that God took up and used in such a remarkable way. And in a sense is still using through those epistles that appear in our New Testament.
Yeah. And we could throw in there as well, I think, because obviously my background is in as a training officer. And I think he was one of the greatest training officers that ever lived as well. Yeah. The way he was able to turn a question round.
Yes, yes.
Which is absolutely brilliant. Good answer. Question three. If you were Prime Minister for the day, bear in mind we're recording this the day after we've got a new Prime Minister in this country, and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, good sir?
Well, this gives me some freedom because I'm not Prime Minister and I'm never going to be Prime Minister. And so I've got freedom to be able to suggest things that maybe it would be extremely difficult for a Prime Minister to be able to do.
Yeah.
But I think I would have to say that I would make some changes to the abortion law. Mm-hmm. Without seeking to exaggerate, I think one of the things that must cause God the greatest anger are the hundreds of thousands of babies that are aborted year after year, nearly a quarter of a million last year in the UK. That's not counting other countries and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think that it was the sad day when, in 1967, the law was changed to allow that. I realize there are difficulties in certain areas, and there are always arguments that other people will make for abortion in certain cases and so on. But I think the whole thing has got now completely out of hand.
Yes. And whilst we live in a democracy where we have freedom of speech, you're fully entitled to share that. And as Prime Minister of the day, that's what you bring in.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Well, this was the easiest question to answer. A Saturday afternoon when Bristol City have won a game.
Which, if we interviewed you 6 months ago, we'd be scratching our heads saying, when was the last game we won home?
Well, I did say when City win.
Yes. Well, we're doing quite well at the moment, I must admit.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, the cat is out of the bag now. You are the chaplain to Bristol City. And the reason why I know you is that I've bumped into you quite a few times at Ashton Gate, which is obviously the home of Bristol City.
Apart from other contacts that we've had as well through the years, of course.
We have as well, yeah. And I always remember you asking me to play football for a team. It was a team from America. And you've been able to procure the Bristol City away kit.
I didn't realise that you were around for that.
Yeah, I was. Yeah,
yes, I do remember that. Yeah,
absolutely. I had an absolute blinder, but no one else remembers that. and you borrowed the Umbro kit, the classic Umbro away kit from our first division days.
Yes.
And it was like, I've worn a proper football kit, yeah.
As I remember, it was an extremely turbulent day, windy day.
It was.
I think we had a problem with the van's door or something like that. And that was, the answer to the next question, but certainly it was quite embarrassing that I borrowed a van and we had a problem with the door because the wind took it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was very windy and rainy. I remember that.
Yes, that's
most
right.
Most of all, I remember wearing the Bristol City away kit, the official Bristol City away kit. Yeah. And I gave it back as well. That's two things I gave back to you. Question five, what has been your most embarrassing moment?
There were a number that I thought of, but they're not for public exposure. But there was one that I did come upon, which even now I break out into a cold sweat when I think of it. I had come across to your side of the water,
mm-hmm.
and I was conducting a convention in the town of Antrim.
Mm-hmm.
And I was staying there with a lady who very kindly one afternoon lent me her car because I needed to buy something, I can't remember what it was, in the town. And so I drove into the town and I didn't often drive in Northern Ireland. I was normally driven.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have remembered that on the occasions when I had been driven, that the person who was driving and stopped in a town and got out, said, as long as you stay there, there isn't a problem. And I'd forgotten that on that occasion when I was driving. So I got out and went into the shop to get whatever I needed to get. When I came out, the street was empty, except for the army, who were just about to blow up this lady's car.
No.
Because they thought in the days of the Troubles that there was a bomb in her car. Fortunately, although I was to be charged, fortunately, the chief constable or whatever was a Christian and was attending the meetings that I was speaking at. And so he let me off.
Wow.
But when I came out and had that, soldier come up to me and say, is this your car, sir? And I said, yes. And then it dawned on me what I had done. And that has to be one of the most embarrassing occasions in my life.
Yeah. And you could have had a criminal record as well.
I could have.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I bet not many people know that story. Thank you, Derek. Well, listen, that leads on, actually, because I mentioned at the top that you were in MWE as well with Peter and with John. Tell us about that. Why it all came up, why you went into MWE and then obviously onto the company you formed together with the other two.
Yeah, well, when I started in the ministry, I started with the National Young Life Campaign as the evangelist for the southwest of England. That was in 1968.
Okay.
During that time, I was invited by John Blanchard, who was in MWE at that time, to share in a mission here in Bristol with him, which was very good of him. And having shared in that mission, he then went back to the council of MWE and said, why don't you approach this young man and invite him to join? Which they did. And that's how I came into MWE. And we worked in MWE for 10 years together. That was particularly significant for me because back in 1960, I'd gone with my parents to the conference that MWE sponsored in Philae, the Christian conference.
Oh, yeah.
And I had responded to the Lord's call to serve him. I didn't actually go to Bible college for another 5 years, but I'd indicated my willingness. And so it was MWE that, in that sense, was the means of me coming into the ministry. And after those 2.5 years with NYLC, I was in MWE and attending the Philae Christian Holiday Crusade year by year for 10 years. And then the three of us felt, as we came up to the 10-year anniversary, that there were some issues that we weren't too happy about. And so we decided with the Lord's guidance that we would come out of MWE and begin Christian Ministries, which we did on the 1st of April, would you believe it? April Fool's Day, 1980. And so that's when Christian Ministries began. And we continued for more than 20 years together.
Yeah.
And then my two older colleagues stepped out from under the umbrella. And just for a few more years, Christian Ministries continued employing me. And then I stepped out from the umbrella. We still have the trust for gift aid purposes, but Christian Ministries now doesn't actually support anyone directly. You know,
yeah.
I'm not employed by them. I'm freelance.
Yeah.
So that's how it all happened. That was the progression.
I've heard of Philae. Tell us more about Philae, because that's all I know, the name that it was a Bible.
Yeah, well, back in the 1950s, Billy Graham came to Haringey and conducted a long crusade that for many, many weeks. And there were those who professed conversion. Mm-hmm. And a man by the name of A. Lindsay Glegg, who was a Christian layman and very much involved in Christian work, and the chairman of MWE, went to Billy Butlin and said, what I'd like to do is put on a Christian holiday for these people in particular and anybody else who wanted to come. And Billy Butlin said, well, you can have the Philae camp after we've finished our season. And so that's really how Philae began. And it started, you know, in the maybe late-ish 1950s and went right through until 1980. It was in Skegness for a couple of years. Yep. And then, of course, with competition from Spring Harvest and so on, it eventually disappeared. But MWE sponsored that. One of the little issues I could confess to now, one of the little issues that John, Peter and I had was that Philae happened 1 week in the year out of the 52.
Uh-huh.
But most of the time in council meetings, we were talking about Philae, not the other 51 weeks of evangelistic ministry that the team were involved in, which was just somewhat frustrating.
Yeah. I suppose nowadays people don't really think much about evangelism as much. MWE, what was that actually MWE's modus operandi?
Movement for World Evangelization was the vision of Thomas Cochrane, its founder, and I think it was a marvelous vision, really. When we used to stand up on the platform and say, we are the movement for world evangelization, it seemed that we were getting too big for our boots. And yet, what a great vision that man had, that he was concerned to reach the world with the gospel.
How long ago was this?
Hmm?
How long ago was this, Derek?
I can't now remember off the cuff when MWE began, but I mean, long before any of us were born.
Okay.
Thomas Cochran was the founder.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So how did they go about it then? It's one thing to have a vision, but how did they do it?
Well, they had a team of evangelists. And maybe I shouldn't have used the word team, because they had individual evangelists under their umbrella, people like David Shepherd and Frank Farley and so on and so forth, even Charles Stern, Skevington Wood and so on. They were under the umbrella of MWE, but they carried on their own ministry. They didn't work together.
Right.
It was only when, in the Lord's will, when we who were younger men then came in and those older people had moved on, that the Lord opened up an opportunity in 1971 for us to conduct a team mission. It was Toxteth Tabernacle in Liverpool who contacted MWE and said, we've got a special celebration coming up, an anniversary of the church, and we'd like to put on some special meetings, but we don't just want to have meetings for the Christians. We want to have some evangelism as well. Would your team come? Well, in that sense, we didn't have a team. We had individuals.
Yeah, yeah.
But that brought us together. And so we put together a program that would involve all of us on the team day by day conducting evangelistic meetings. So they were not, therefore, simply public rallies. They were coffee mornings. They were visits to schools. They were visits to workplaces and so on and so forth. And that really was almost forced upon us because of the circumstances, because how were we going to hold a team mission? Have one guy preach in the evening, then the others sit and listen to him. Mm. And then the next night, another one preaches and everybody else listens to him. So we formed a program. We produced a program that would keep us all busy. And we found it worked because we were reaching people that would never darken the door of a church or come to a crusade rally. But we were going to them, and we were meeting them in somebody's home, a Christian's home, or a Christian was opening up their place of work for a buffet lunch or something like that, and we would bring a brief message to that. And the whole program for the 10 years that we were in MWE developed in that way, and we called it hospitality evangelism, and we majored more on those informal events than we did on the public meetings.
Wow. So what made you become an... Obviously, this is a simple question in some ways, but why go down the line of being an evangelist rather than say, I'm going to be a pastor or I'm going to go something like that?
Well, I went to Bible College in 1965, the London Bible College, which again was interesting because having responded to that call to serve the Lord in any place, at any time, at any cost, at Filey in 1960, that challenge having been issued by Mr. A. Lindsay Glegg himself to all of us in that congregation, the following morning we would meet and they would have Bible colleges and missionary societies exhibiting. And as well as having a little pep talk by somebody at the front, we would then go around and meet with various organizations and so on with a view to the future. And so when it came to Bible College, I remembered that I'd spoken to the people at London Bible College. And so I applied to the London Bible College and did a 3-year course there, during which time I never felt any inclination toward overseas missionary work. But I did feel that it could be either evangelism or pastoral ministry. And that continued right up to the time I had completed my course. And then my wife and I, and we were married then, put up the late Reverend Jeffrey King for a convention that was being held in our home church. And Jeffrey King was the vice president of National Young Life Campaign. And he knew I'd come to or was coming toward the end of my course. And he said, we're looking for an evangelist in the Southwest because John Blanchard has moved on to MWE and there's a vacancy there. And so that's really how I began in evangelism. In the earlier years, I did have invitations from churches to be the pastor, but I never felt that it was the right move. And even now, these 50-something years later, I never felt that I missed out on that, that I really should have taken that up. It didn't disturb National Young Life Campaign when one of my pastors said that he thought I was more suited to the pastoral ministry, because they didn't want somebody who would just swan around the southwest of England speaking at evangelistic events and not giving some pastoral care to young people who belonged to the membership of the National Young Life Campaign. And so it worked for them. They said, well, that's fine. We want somebody with a pastoral lean who will be able to look after the young people in the Southwest and encourage them in evangelism, as well as taking evangelistic events himself.
So perhaps we could then get a proper definition here, because it seems it's getting more and more blurred, I think. What is your definition of a pastor, and what is your definition of an evangelist, please, Derek?
Well, I think that both of those are gifted by God in a particular way. I think that there can be a crossover to some extent. I think we in evangelism, my colleagues and I, were always viewed as those with the gift of teaching, a teaching evangelism. That is, there was content, if you like, in our ministry. That's why that we were equally able to speak at conventions and so on and so forth. So whereas one would probably say that the particular gift of a pastor was a teaching ministry and a caring ministry for his parishioners, the gift of the evangelist was the preaching of the gospel to the unconverted directly. But I say there is a crossover there, and I've never limited myself to pure evangelistic work, and always been very privileged and happy to be engaged in pastoral ministry, Sunday ministry, convention ministry, and as you indicated, two or three books.
Yeah, exactly. Looking back now on your life to date, and obviously the world we live in at the moment in 2022, what changes have you seen with people wanting to know who Jesus is compared to when you first started?
Well, I think for me, the thing that immediately comes to my mind is the fact that in the early days of my youth and in even early ministry, we had good congregations in our churches. Not all of those people were Christians, but you were speaking to people who may have been nominal Christians, maybe made no pretense to be a Christian, but they did attend church. And so you'd have pretty good attendance at churches. I think what you have now in the main, and I'm speaking a little generally, are people who are committed Christians in church. In other words, you're having to go out and you're having to share the gospel with people who are non-church. And that really is why our hospitality evangelism was, dare I say, so effective. Because I often said when I was talking to a church in our MWE and Christian Ministries days, I would say, I don't think that there's a preacher in the world who can draw a crowd of unchurched, unconverted people. And that was a loaded comment, because I knew they would think of Billy Graham. But so I would go on to say, I fully respect Billy Graham's ministry, but just let me ask you this question. How many of your neighbors in your street, how many of your work colleagues actually went to that Billy Graham mission when it was held? Not a lot. You know, it's a lot of people at the Billy Graham missions were those who had some connection to churches and so on, didn't they? Or they were parents of children, or they were children of parents, or so on, bussed in by churches and so on and so forth. Excellent. Nothing wrong with that at all. But did we really reach en masse the person in the street? And I don't think that that was the case. And that was how we made our case for hospitality evangelism. You go to your neighbors, you invite them to come into your home for coffee, and I'll come along, and as simply as possible, I will explain the Christian gospel to them. And the response that you normally had was that you'd got a church that was evangelizing. You didn't simply have an evangelist who came and preached in the pulpit and everybody else sat and listened. You had people who, for the first time in their lives, had gone to their neighbors, gone to their work colleagues, brought them, invited them with some trepidation into a non-threatening situation where we could present the gospel. And I think that that situation, and I'm speaking in very general terms, you know, because there are occasions when you can hold an evangelistic meeting, public meeting, and invite people who to come and have interviews and the gospel and so on and so forth. I don't decry that for one minute, but I'm saying I think we're now living in days where we have, as you implied in your question, a majority of people who've never darkened the door of a church, haven't got a clue, not the slightest idea what the Christian gospel is about. Now, how are you going to reach them? I often said to churches, you may feel very comfortable sat in your church with your hymn book in your hand, but put yourself in the position of somebody who's never been in a church, and they come in and they're given a hymn book. And somebody announces a hymn. Do they stand up for this, or what do they do? You know, you've got to try and put yourself in a non-church person's position, and to come into a home and have a cup of coffee and meet somebody there, far less threatening, and yet they'd hear the same message that they would have heard had they come into the church itself.
So do you think churches are going back to your kind, and I must admit it does sound spot on, your kind of hospitality evangelism these days?
We wouldn't ever claim to have introduced it. In fact, when I wrote a little book on using your home for evangelism, I made the point that the early chapters of the New Testament are really basically home evangelism, aren't they? Mm-hmm. You know, there was public preaching, of course there was, but they went from house to house, we read, don't we, sharing the gospel. Yeah. And so, you know, what we were doing is not something new. I sometimes think of some of the evangelists of the past, and they would come to a town and they would take over the largest hall in the town, and they would preach the gospel, and people would be there. They'd be packed out night after night. And I thought, we were never around in that era, in the sense of being preachers in that era. I'm almost tempted to say it must have been comparatively easy for them, because they knew they'd have a packed hall. Mm-hmm. They knew they'd have a packed church. And that was the way it was worked in those days. There was apparently no need to have this down-to-earth hospitality style evangelism, because you could get people to church, because very often people would attend church anyway on a Sunday, even if they were not committed Christians.
Yeah, yeah.
So to invite them to come to an evangelistic rally, well, that was you know, no problem. They would come, and they would come to in Bristol here, the Colston Hall, or you know, elsewhere, and there they would hear the gospel from, you know, Eric Hutchings or Alan Redpath or whatever, and that was great. It was marvelous. But then, you know, people stopped attending church, and you had generations growing up that were non-church, and that meant that, of course, they wouldn't come along to an evangelistic rally, however warmly you invited them. And certainly we never felt that somebody would come because Derek Cleave was speaking anywhere. You know, they wouldn't know me from a hole in the head. So it needed the neighbor or the work colleague to invite them to come and hear this person who was going to talk about the Christian message.
Yeah, yeah. Funny you say Colston Hall. We had on a previous podcast Noel Richards.
Yes.
He grew up in Llantrisant in Wales.
Yes.
And he came over for one of these meetings at the Colston Hall. And that was the defining moment for him, knowing that that's what he believed God wanted him to do.
Yeah.
So it makes what happens. Yeah.
In the very early 1960s, we had the Youth for Christ Congress here in Bristol. And I think I would point to that as the first time when I was ever involved in any Christian service, because you couldn't do it today. But in those days, young Christians could go out on the streets on the city centre and encourage people to come back to a local hall there that was called the Prince's Hall. Mm-hmm. And there in the evening, there would be some meetings held in addition to the main meetings that were held in the Colston Hall. And, you know, it was just great. We were thrilled to be involved in that kind of in that kind of work. And I think that that was the first time that I, with other young people, got involved in evangelism.
See, I remember going to the Colston Hall on a Friday night, which was against what I would normally do on a Friday night in those days, to a thing called a Dirty Hands Tour. And Chris, oh, what was his surname? From Salt Trust. He was trying to get your hands dirty for Christ. That was the idea, just go out there and get your hands dirty. And the reason I'm saying this is because there were some statistics when I first joined Christian Radio way back in the mid-1990s. One of the first statistics I ever heard was that the Billy Graham organisation said that only around about 10% of those make a commitment at one of their rallies actually last the course. So why is it then, if only 10%, what about those 90%, bearing in mind that off-grid Christianity is for those people who feel disillusioned? What do you think is the, or are the reasons for that?
I think the Billy Graham organization themselves, in some sense, were aware of part of the problem. And the accusation was, it's that singing Just As I Am at the end of the meeting that does it. You know what I mean? That's what people thought. And that's why Billy Graham thought, all right, well, we'll do it without that. We won't have any hymn at the end of the meeting in that sense. I'll just invite people to come. And in the silence, you know, we'll wait for people to come. So I think they were conscious of the emotional pull, you know, that an event like that would have. And I don't know what the percentage would be, but that mightn't be wildly out. But having said that, there were thousands and thousands of people who truly came to Christ during that Haringey mission in the 50s that I referred to, and became ministers of the gospel in Britain, became missionaries overseas, and so on and so forth. And so for that reason, I wouldn't decry what's termed mass evangelism, but I recognize its dangers. And I'm sure that Billy Graham would have recognized that equally.
Well, do you think the church, I'm talking about the whole church now, not a particular denomination, should maybe put their hands up and say, we've got it wrong?
No, I wouldn't have thought, no. We were referring to George Whitfield earlier on, and he would speak to, well, I understand that he spoke to a crowd in Boston, USA, of 20,000 people, which was larger than the total population of Boston at that time.
Wow.
Now, I wonder what they would say about responses to the preaching of the gospel back then in the 18th century, whether there wasn't a similar issue that there will always be. In those mass events, people who will respond and yet not realize, you know, what they've responded to.
Yeah.
And that's why I think one of the questions that advisors and counselors were suggested should be asked of people that they spoke to, you know, why have you come forward this evening?
Yes.
Now that, If you're discerning and careful, that should indicate whether this person has truly understood why they have responded. And I think if that was done, then you know, you would get better figures, let's say, because there wouldn't be as many so-called false conversions.
Yeah.
One of the little dangers is that, you know, and whether this is true or apocryphal, I don't know. One of the great dangers is that sometimes when you then later on, years later, speak to somebody and they say, oh, well, I did that at the Billy Graham mission and it didn't make a difference in my life, you see. And that's always going to be a danger. But I don't think that we can dismiss all of the tremendous benefits of what we term mass evangelism, as long as the gospel is preached. That's the important thing. And God is the one who does the work, the true work in people's lives.
So for those that are listening today, Derek, you know, who really do feel disillusioned, they might not be angry at God, but they're angry at the way the church has dealt that them stuff or whatever. With all that going on, what would you say to them?
I would say that if that's how they feel, then for the time being, just forget all of that, church and the way they've been dealt with and so on and so forth, and look to Christ. In other words, find out the truth of the gospel. When the Apostle Paul wrote his letter to the Romans, in his prologue in that first chapter, he mentioned the gospel on, I think, 8 occasions in those first 16 or 17 verses. But what I've often said in a message is this: whenever he mentioned Jesus Christ as well in those verses, he's mentioning the gospel. In other words, Jesus Christ is the gospel. In other words, you want to know what Christianity is, then, and you want to know what the gospel is about, then find out through looking at Jesus Christ and examining his life and his preaching and his declarations and so on and so forth.
No doubt people have come up to you and complained in the past or whatever. I'm not trying to be negative here, but what is the overriding feeling as to why they're feeling so despondent and disillusioned, do you think, Derek?
Well, I think perhaps the reason is that we're all human. And, you know, I mean, we have to be honest and say there are problems in churches with committed Christians, you know, and, you know, it's too easy to offend people and upset people. And we've all been guilty of doing that. And I think we just have to recognize that that those things are, you know, are going to happen. We're human. We've all got feet of clay. We're not asking people to look at us. We're always endeavoring to point people to Jesus Christ, who is no disappointment.
Yeah, thank you. Great answer. You mentioned hospitality evangelism. I want to take you back to the 1850s, 1860s, where there was another form of evangelism, because church leaders were realizing that the only day off people had from work was on a Sunday. And men, for some reason, weren't turning up to church. And the reason was because they liked playing football. So some of the vicars and other leaders of churches thought, we'll get our own football team together. Now, it's my understanding that because of that, you've got quite a few teams in the professional league these days that come from that movement.
Yeah. Yeah,
which brings on very nicely to your job as chaplain to the greatest team in the world, the mighty Reds themselves. Bristol City. So how did you get involved with that, Derek?
Well, as evangelists, my colleagues and I went to the evangelist conference that was held in 1982, at which a rather aggressive Anglican clergyman from Liverpool was introducing us in one of the seminars to the organization Christians in Sport, which had actually only just entered the United Kingdom. Well known in America, but it had just come over here. And he was telling us about Christians in Sport. I think he had some position within that organization, as well as being an Anglican vicar. And he threw out this challenge. We ought to have a football chaplain in every football league club in the country. And my colleague and dear friend, Peter Anderson, nudged me and said, here you are, you ought to get in there. And I smiled at him and forgot about it. That night I came back to Bristol and I went to my youngest son's carol concert. And I sat next to a friend who was a director of Bristol City Football Club. He had rescued the club. I don't mean so much financially, but with the other directors, had provided a plan by which Bristol City, who had sunk from Division One, as it was in those days, right down to the bottom of the league, and were virtually out of business. And he had conceived this plan with others to rescue the club. It meant eight of the players tearing up their contracts, and so on and so forth. All of that is history. And I sat next to him. He was a parent as well at that carol service.
Who was the director, Derek?
It was Derek Connor.
Yeah.
Who was the
Park
the
Furnishers, wasn't it?
Owner of Park Furnishers. Yeah. And I mentioned, just as a conversation starter, what I'd heard during that very day at that conference. I said, hey, you never guess what somebody suggested today. He said, that's a good idea. He said, we've got a board meeting next week. I'm going to mention it. And truthfully, I forgot about it again until he rung and said, we had the board meeting last night. You're on. You were appointed. I said, whoa, just a moment. What am I on? You know, and he said, no, they thought there was no good reason. Why not? Well, of course, given our circumstances, one can appreciate that. You know, they thought it was a good idea. And the manager, Terry Cooper at that time, is 100% behind the idea, not least, as I found out later, because he had had a chaplain at Leeds back in his early days as an apprentice and so on, called John Jackson. I don't know what John Jackson did, but he obviously impressed Terry Cooper. And so I went to see Terry Cooper before I'd agreed to do it. And we had a cup of coffee and so on and so forth. And it went on from there. So that's how it started in December 1982, which makes it 40 years this December.
Wow. Wow. And that was in the pits of despair of Bristol City, because 1982 was when it all went horribly wrong. And if anybody wants to know more about that story, just Google Ashton Gate 8 and it will tell you all about it. Wow. So what was your job role in those days then as chaplain to Bristol
City? Well, I agreed with Terry that I would come in on a Friday after training and just mix and mingle. And I think I ought to say as well, I'm also chaplain at Ashton Gate. In other words, the offices, the ground staff, the maintenance and so on and so forth. So I do my rounds. And so I went in on a Friday. I've never in 40 years been snubbed by any of the players.
Wow.
I'm sure that they didn't understand at the beginning, you know, who I was and what I did. And then, of course, that was Friday. And then Saturday, we might have had a home game. And then another whole week before I had any contact again. So I just decided off the cuff, I'll go in on Tuesdays as well. And so apart from the time when I've been involved in missions or overseas or whatever, I've gone in to the club every Tuesday and every Friday for these past 40 years. I could go in every day. Nobody would stop me. But that seemed to be a nice balance of the week. Tuesday, Friday, Saturday home game, Tuesday, Friday, you know, and then an away game, of course. I don't usually attend away games because of Sunday preaching. And if I'm going some distance, and because I've always been involved in an itinerant ministry, you know, traveling, I don't want to get back from an away game at, you know,
3 o'clock.
Midnight, and then leave at 7 o'clock the next morning and drive to my preaching appointment. So I rarely, unless I'm preaching nearby on the Sunday, I would rarely go to an away game.
Wow. So what do you actually do on a Tuesday and a Friday when you get to the training
centre? Well, things have changed somewhat now, only because we now have a training ground.
Yeah.
Which we didn't have before. We had to use school grounds or something like that. We have what's called the High Performance Centre, which is no more than 10 minutes from home. And so tomorrow, being a Friday, I will go up there by 8:15. And the players wander in and I'm in the restaurant. I don't have any breakfast. I do have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or whatever. And I mix and mingle with them as they come in and have a chat with one another. And then I walk around that building where the coaches, the football coaches are situated, or the under 21s are now there. And I'm involved with them as well at the moment. The under 18s are also there. Lots of office staff. The recruitment center is there. The media center is there. So I do all of that. And then when the players begin to drift off for training, I then drive down to Ashton Gate, again, about a 10-minute journey. And then I do my rounds at Ashton Gate. And that finishes just before lunch. And then I come home for lunch. So, that's my morning taken up on Tuesdays and Fridays.
Wow. I was talking to Dave Gill yesterday, who is the Bristol Rovers chaplain.
Yes.
Great humility shown by both of us, I have to say. And he was telling me that, one of the things he did miss was practicing, even if you just have a knockabout with the players afterwards. But also, back in my days of yore as a radio presenter, I used to do a chaplain of the day for one of the football teams. And I remember that the chaplain for West Ham telling me that his role was also to be the go-between between fans who had major issues with the club or whatever. And he'd be there and he'd also be asked to take funerals and stuff like that. What about yourself?
Yes, exactly that. I think I'm still listed in the digital program. We don't have a printed one now, but I think I'm still listed as the chaplain there. If people are aware of that, then they can get in touch with me. And there are a number of occasions when I've taken funerals, both of fans and also members of staff.
Wow.
And one or two weddings as well.
Yeah, I was going to say. I remember.
Yeah, there are all those kind of things as well.
Yeah. So, which players have you taken weddings for then?
Do you remember Howard Pritchard?
Yeah, very much so. Great winger.
Welsh international.
Yeah, yes, number 7 shirt.
Yeah, I took his wedding. Just incidentally, I ought to say, in case we forget, we now have a chaplaincy team.
Okay.
Because Bristol City Football Club is now under the umbrella of Bristol Sport.
Yes.
Bristol Sport also has Bristol Bears, the rugby. It has the Flyers, which is the basketball.
Oh, yeah.
It has the women's football, who are doing exceedingly well at the moment. And it also has women's rugby. And they're all under the umbrella of Bristol Sport. So I look after the football. We have somebody that looks after rugby. We have somebody who looks after the women's football, and we have somebody who looks after the basketball.
Yeah.
Don't have anybody for the women's rugby as yet, but we also have my substitute, Chris James, local pastor here, tremendous help. We gel so beautifully together. He only comes on a Friday because we don't want too heavy a presence on us two on the football side.
Yeah.
But I particularly value him because he's called lead chaplain. So when there are issues that generally need to be dealt with admin-wise, Chris James looks after that and not me. There's obviously been a lot of work on safeguarding over these past months, and Chris has dealt with that with the safeguarding officer. And so I'm very grateful to Chris for doing that. All being well, he would step in when I step out. That's the idea. And I hope that he's not, I did say to him the other day, I hope he's not frustrated that, at the moment I'm still around. And he indicates that he's not frustrated at all. And he's very happy to keep it at the level that it is. So we do have this chaplaincy team, which is very exciting.
Yeah. How relevant do you think is chaplaincy these days to a football team? Bear in mind, you've got so many other avenues of life that's being thrust at a footballer.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is valuable. We are careful not to give the impression that whenever we open our mouth, we preach at them.
Yeah.
But you see, one of the big things, in fact, I would almost say the biggest thing about chaplaincy is that we maintain confidentiality.
Yes.
So that there is actually no one else that guarantees that as far as players or staff are concerned. But it's our mantra. It's the fact that we will not pass on that information to anyone else unless it is absolutely necessary. Yeah. And under the umbrella of safeguarding, if there was a young player that was being abused in some way, we would feel obliged to be able to take that, with their permission, to take that to someone else. We'd have to. But outside of that, you know, we maintain confidentiality, and therefore the players feel quite confident in talking with us about all kinds of issues. So, and we just seek to apply our Christian faith and the gospel to those situations as the Lord enables us.
So going back those from the early days, 40 years ago, and obviously Terry Cooper with his Leeds United experience obviously gave you a warm welcome. Do you feel that today in life itself, there's been much of a change in the way they react to you?
Do you mean in the club?
Yeah, well, yeah, in the club, but also, you know, outside as well.
No, I'm sure that's not the case. I'm kind of almost going back to my hospitality evangelism days and saying, you know, the important thing is that not just we, let me term myself a professional in the best sense, not just we professionals, but that, you know, the man in the street can be encouraged to talk to people about their Christian faith. And I've been grateful for the chaplaincy because it's put me, if you like, in the position that I've often put other people when I've challenged them on this hospitality style of evangelism. I've said, you've got to go to your neighbor, you've got to go to your work colleague, and you get them to come to your home, and I will then speak to them. Now, when I go to the football club, I have very, very few speaking or preaching opportunities. So I then have to do what I've been encouraging those people through the years to do. And that's good for me. And I think that that has to be, well, surely that's the way in which we do evangelize, you know, by Christians themselves sharing their faith with other people. Yeah. We mustn't depend or rely on the professionals to do it for us, which is probably what we did for many years, you know, when churches were full, you know, the pastor did it, the evangelist did it. You got somebody in to do it for you. We're not living in those days now. And so we all have to be engaged in sharing our faith with other people.
Well, in closing, I could listen to you all the time. And obviously, there'd be plenty of people going, no, don't talk anymore about Bristol City. So I'm not, of course, I won't talk about them anymore. But for those listening at the moment thinking, do you know what? That makes total sense. What would you say to them about, go on, let's do some hospitality evangelism. What advice would you give them?
The thought that immediately comes to my mind is that they may feel, well, yeah, I could invite somebody into my home, but I mean, I wouldn't be capable of talking to them. And there are resources available that could be used. You know, there are lots of very short talks that have been given by various people, Roger Carswell and so on and so forth, that could be used in that situation. And all that would be required then would be for that person to maybe at the end of that say, well, what did you think about that? And so on and so forth. And get it. They wouldn't have to preach a message. But I think it's getting alongside people and providing the opportunity. I just feel that, you know, the vast majority of people haven't got a clue what we believe.
Yeah.
And they need to know. They need to have that opportunity. Dare I use the word, they need to have that chance to actually have heard the gospel, the true gospel, at least once.
Well, has the hunger gone, do you think?
The hunger?
Yeah, from people on the street.
No, I don't think so, because we've proved over and over again when we've spoken to people and preached the gospel in those informal situations, people have said, you know, never thought it was that. Never heard that message before in my life. You know, they could see the relevance of it to everyday life and to the world in which we live. And as we've often said, the more difficult the world in which we live becomes, the more relevant the gospel is in that situation.
Yeah. And I'm sure that, well, mentioning the certain football club, there's a chaplain, people are still wanting to know who you are and they're not being antagonistic to you at all.
No. No, I mean, I'm very grateful that I've always been well received.
Yes,
I mean, I'm sure that there have been those that have been more cautious in their approach because they were, well, footballers are not only superstitious, they can be suspicious as well.
Mm.
And I would have been viewed, I'm sure, by some in the early days as a hanger-on because yes. Footballers get lots of hangers-on.
Yeah.
But I was not there for that purpose.
Yeah.
I've often used the illustration that I heard another chaplain give when he said, when I speak to the players, what I tell them is, I want to be the safety net that a trapeze artist is very glad is there if required.
Yes.
In other words, I'm not going to unnecessarily interfere in your life, but I want you to know that if you need me, I'm here for you.
Yes. Well, that is a fantastic line to finish with as well. Derek, just before we find out who your Christian hero is, I'd like to say this has been a BCSC production. Derek Cleaver's been our special guest today. We've run out of time because I was going to ask you about a certain quote that Peter Anderson said as well, which was Christianity was a performance, not an experience. And that was given to him when he was growing up about him. And we could have talked about that, but maybe another time. Maybe another time. That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah.
Derek, thank you for joining us today. All that remains for me to say now is, who is your Christian hero and why?
Probably in every Christian's life, there's one pastor that they would call their pastor, the minister who had the most influence in their lives, perhaps during their formative years. And a man by the name of Alan Toms was certainly that for Margaret and me. I was 13 when he began his ministry in our church, and I was 26 when he left in 1968. And during those 13 years, I'd been converted, baptized, married, attended Bible college, and began that ministry in the National Young Life Campaign. The membership would remember those 13 years at our church as a very happy and spiritually profitable time. Since Margaret and I were young people, it was in that area of the work that we witnessed Alan Tom's faithfulness. At that time, our young people's meeting was held on a Wednesday under the banner of Christian Endeavor. Mm-hmm. And one of the requirements of that organization was that on one Wednesday a month, we had to hold what they called a consecration service, at which the Christian young people repeated a covenant of commitment. And I, looking back now, it's remarkable that on many of those Wednesday evenings, once a month, Alan came to bring a message to us, recognizing the value of laying a biblical foundation in our lives. As I remember, there was a series on the Second Coming, which later was turned into a book. Several of those young people went on to serve the Lord in different parts of the world. And we have to remember that those Wednesday evenings that Alan spoke at were in addition to two services on a Sunday and a message given at the church prayer meeting on a Tuesday. And in those days, there was no music group, there was no chairman to ease the burden. The pastor did it all. And it's been a joy that Alan and Enid, his wife, attended some of my conferences and met up with me in their retirement years in churches in different places. And I trust that they were encouraged in seeing their young people following their wonderful example in serving the Lord. And just to say, Alan Toms went to be with the Lord last week, the day before his 96th birthday. And I nominate him as my hero.
Wow. What a fantastic hero. Someone that would be unsung to many millions that no one ever heard of. And I think that's a great encouragement to us all. For those that would like to get hold of Derek, or maybe been challenged and want to know more, you can contact us at OGC, that's OGC, Off-Grid Christianity, OGC at accessradio.biz, and biz is spelled B-I-Z. Derek, it's been phenomenal having you on here. Thank you so much for everything you share, from hospitality, evangelism, to what makes people tick. Look forward to speaking to you in the near future. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, Martin. Thank you.